to 2:04, like to be specific. Well, of course, as the former Time Lord would appreciate, he is here. He was recently seen opposite Michael Sheen, who I believe he knows, in the BBC lockdown comedy Staged. He's back with a new series of his podcast, David Tennant Does a Podcast With. It's David Tennant. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Okay, is this hair for a role, or is this lockdown hair that you still haven't bothered to kind of go to a hairdresser and sort out? Because you've got a lovely, lovely mane.
Can you see me? I can't see you. You have the advantage over me.
I know.
What kind of hair have you got at the moment?
Well, I had mine. Mine was kind of 90s indie band until last week when I got it. I got it kind of de-suaded. It was kind of suedey before then.
And then I went,
I'm not sure the Shed 7 look is something I still need to be rocking in 2020. Right. So I've had it slightly cut. Whereas you've got this beautiful mane.
I do have a lot of hair at the moment. I had extensions in. What? I was doing Around the World in 80 Days when the world shut down. So I got hustled home from Cape Town and locked in my house along with everyone else. And I had these extensions in, which have now since all fallen out. But I now have hair longer than even when they were in. So if we do manage to get back to filming, I can do it without the extensions, I think, which is, you know, there's got to be some advantages to this crazy time, haven't there?
So the hairdressers have been open. So why haven't you gone and...
Because we're hoping to go back to filming, aren't we? So I've got to keep it long.
But they're not extensions, are they, that you've got in
there? No, but my hair, I've caught up with the extensions.
So you won't have to, you can spend less time. You can spend less time.
Real life has replaced the fiction.
Now, I know you must be tired, but I'm going to have to do it because it'd be remiss of me not to, of Orvig having to mention Michael Sheen when you're interviewed. Right, because it's almost as if you've begun to come as a package, the two of you.
Yes, it's funny that, isn't it? I mean, we'd never really worked together before a couple of years ago, and now we seem to be one unit with the sort of the Anton Deck of drama, which is fine by me. I mean, you know, there are worse people to be locked in some kind of unholy matrimony with. So I'm very happy to be associated with Michael in that way, but. Yes, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, I think,
how long have you been mates? Like, genuinely been mates? Because it is a bromance. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Well, we've known each other since we did a film together, although we had no scenes together. When was that? Long time ago, 2001 or something. Really early on, and then we've never worked together. We've always known each other, but not that well until we did Good Omens together, which was 3 years ago now. So really until then, I wouldn't say we knew each other beyond a kind of a nodding acquaintance. But
so what but clicked?
I don't know.
Because you seem to get on really well. Like, beyond just, you know, we're colleagues and we see each other at award ceremonies.
I don't know. I suppose we're probably sort of... maturing into grumpy old men at about the same rate, I imagine. There's probably something it's odd when somebody's had. We often talk about this actually that we've worked together, although we've known each other, we hadn't worked together really before we did Good Omens together, because you kind of usually get one or the other of us. You know, there's usually a Michael Sheen shaped hole that, if I was lucky, I'd sometimes get to fill in a production. There's really two.
What a sentence.
There's rarely two, so it's quite unusual that we would get to spend that much time together. So I suppose maybe we're, you know, been on fairly similar journeys and just never been able to kind of take the time to hang out together before. I'm not sure, but it's been very joyous. I haven't seen him either. You know, we did Staged.
Yeah, of course.
Locked in our own houses. So we haven't actually seen each other for months and months and months, but I do feel like we've been spending a lot of time together, yeah.
Is acting a competitive craft for you?
I mean, not principally, no. I don't think it can be, because I think it's about collaboration and it's about you know, sharing moments, to whether you're doing a scene together or whether you're rehearsing something or whether you're developing something. It's that's got to be a collaborative thing, and I don't think competitiveness helps with that. That's not to say that outside the kind of actual work itself, of course, it's a very hierarchical profession. So it's hard not to sometimes get little fleeting stabs of professional jealousy or schadenfreude as you look at your contemporaries sort of go up and down the slippery pole, I suppose. But I don't think that's very healthy or useful. And I think as you get sort of older and wiser and more bitter, I think that's, you sort of, I think maybe that's a young man's game, the competitiveness.
When was the last time you went for a role that you didn't get? Do you have to go up for roles anymore? Even?
Not very often these days, if I'm honest, but it still does happen.
Were you up for Hannibal?
I was up for Hannibal, yeah. Yeah, that was a few years ago now.
It was.
And I didn't get that. Yes, that was weird. That's got rather reported, didn't it? Which is usually, that's the weird bit. Usually the getting of the auditioning and the meeting people it all happens sort of behind closed doors. So there's a kind of unspoken rule amongst actors that you don't mention the jobs you didn't get or turned down, because that means somebody else was second choice. There's an honour amongst thieves there that those things aren't spoken about. But yes, Hannibal, I did go up for and had a couple of meetings with and about, and was very keen on. But I think they quite rightly got Mads Mikkelsen, didn't they?
Mm.
Who was much better than I would have been.
Oh, well, we will never know. But you were you folded in at some point? Because the creator of Hannibal did want you. He's a huge fan of yours.
What do you mean? What does folded in mean?
Well, I mean, you know, you get, I don't know, like, you know, when you sometimes see people in a bar in EastEnders and the Queen Vic just standing there in the background, just go, okay, yeah, give him a nod, just to say, yeah, go. He wanted to be in it. We couldn't get you in it, but look, there you go.
Oh, I see.
There you go, holding an axe in the background of Hannibal.
Yes, I could have been, couldn't I? No, they never happened. Yeah, furious. Never got over it.
So that's, how far into your career were you by the stage that you didn't have to kind of audition anymore? How many years was it?
I don't know. That's a good question. It sort of creeps up on you, I suppose, because I'm still not, you know, there are still, I auditioned for something last year, I think. That was the first audition for a while, which I didn't get, incidentally. But yes, it sort of creeps up on you that things
God,
just...
tell us. Go on.
No, I can't. It would be ignoble.
Were you upset, or have you steeled yourself because of years of
terrible
rejection?
I plainly didn't get it. It was a very poor meeting all round. It went very badly. So I knew I there was no, I mean, disappointment possibly, but certainly no surprise.
Oh, you knew you weren't going to get it because of the meeting?
Oh God, no, it was a disaster. It was awful.
Why was the meeting so bad?
I don't know. You know, when you just sort of, you're going, oh, I'm not what these people are looking for.
Americans
today.
Or British people?
Yeah, yeah.
Americans,
yeah,
right. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Don't say like that. I like working for Americans.
Oh, I'm married to an American. I like Americans.
Oh, yeah, well, there you go. Right. Yeah, but you said that like with some, oh, American. Americans, was it?
Hey, they're so uncouth, David. They clearly didn't understand you.
They didn't understand me. Right. Well, give it someone better. That's what happened.
So
you
knew in the meeting, wow, this is going a bit southwards.
Yeah. I did.
Do you go into those meetings with an agent or do you go in yourself?
No. You just go yourself, yeah. You just poodle along, get the tube, turn up, say your name at the desk, sit there, look at all the people that you often see at the same things, all the people that go up for the same jobs as you. Oh, how you doing? Yeah, oh. Another one, yeah. Oh, good luck, you say, through gritted teeth, not meaning it. Yes, there's a whole routine to it.
You didn't take public transport.
I think I did. Yeah, I think I did.
Can you still wander around on public transport? And
just keep moving. You keep moving. You wear a cunning disguise and you keep moving. It's fine.
You just get a Michael Sheen wig.
Because then people would think I was Michael Sheen and that, you know. And he's very sought after for public appearances.
So, okay, very successful first season, it has to be said, of your podcast. Olivia Colman,
oh, yeah.
James Corden, Ian McKellen, Whoopi Goldberg, Jennifer Garner,
yeah.
Tina Fey.
Michael Sheen.
Yeah, I don't want to include him because that seems like you just called up your mate. Right, that's not
that's
booking.
What most of them were.
Yeah, that's what
that's
I'm
what
looking at this list, and I'm trying to work out who was it that you didn't that you couldn't just text out of that list of that first series: Olivia Colman, James Corden, Ian McKellen, Sir Ian McKellen, Whoopi Goldberg, yes. Jennifer Garner. Who was it that you had to go through someone that you had to kind of work hard for?
I had to go through someone for Whoopi,
right,
and Tina Fey,
right.
I'm trying to think now.
How long was that process?
It sort of happened over a few months. Sort of at various. We sort of banked them a little bit when I was in various different places. So there were a few. This season's been a bit more. There are fewer sort of people I can just call up on this season, and that's partly because I'd done a lot of them already, and also because it was recorded under slightly different circumstances because we were in lockdown, so it was going to be remote anyway. So it was less about, oh, I'm in LA that week, so why don't I try and do Jen Garner and Kristen and John Hamm while I'm there. It was a bit less like that. It was a bit more sort of, oh, well, we're all stuck in our house, so who should we approach, really? I mean, there are a couple of good mates in there this year, but there's a few more people I hadn't known previously.
Why the US politician Stacey Abrams?
Because I'm absolutely obsessed with what's going on over there. And she is one of the sort of prime movers in the Democratic movement at the moment. She's a potential VP candidate for Joe Biden. I had heard that she was a bit of a Doctor Who fan, so I thought, well, that's my in. That's my in to sort of be able to get some kind of perspective on the madness that is US politics at the moment and try and, see what her journey is through this and get some kind of idea, some kind of insight into what's going to happen in November.
What is it that you're so obsessed with when it comes to US politics? We had John Sopel, of course, BBC's America editor on this show, has written a book about his year spent at the White House, which I strongly suggest if you're obsessed with it, you should.
Oh, sure.
You should get hold of. It's a brilliant read, David. But what is it that interests you?
Oh, because it's so serious. Because it's so desperately serious for the whole world. Because America's at a real tipping point. I think there's somebody in the White House who would not traditionally be elected to that office, and he is not behaving traditionally in that office, and there's a real danger that he is going to attempt to transform what democracy means in that country, and where America leads, the world follows. And I would suggest that some leaders in countries not too far away from where we're sitting right now are watching the Trump playbook with interest and are taking some lessons from it, which I don't think are very, I think are dangerous for the future of our democracy. I think the idea that truth is a malleable concept is something that politicians have always indulged in a bit, but we're at a new level now where if we just keep saying something isn't true, eventually we stop being asked about it. You know, eventually it becomes the new normal. Eventually things aren't analysed and considered anymore, and people's rights can be diminished and groups can be marginalised and we can stop questioning it because the news cycle moves on. And if that's exploited cunningly enough by people with vested interests who are more interested in things other than the preservation of our nation, then it can become, well, it won't be the country that we recognise. And I think Donald Trump's a very extreme example of that, but I think it's happening all over the world and I think it's happening here. And I think it's something we all have to guard against. And I think if the Democrats don't win in November, I think America, the America that we have known all our lives, will cease to be. The Supreme Court will almost certainly swing irretrievably to the far, far right, which means a lot of the human rights that people come to expect from the largest democracy in the world will evaporate. And with that will be accountability, and I think it's really dangerous and really serious and historically fascinating, but precipitous for all of us living through these times.
What role do you think actors should play in political campaigning?
Oh, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because why should anyone listen to me? And that's why I'm not asking. And I, that's why I'm interested in
speaking to someone like Stacey Abrams. But you have campaigned before, haven't you, for the Labour Party?
A little, but I do it sparingly. I try not to do it too much, because partly because I'm not qualified to do it, not because I believe I should or shouldn't, just because I believe there are people who are cleverer and better at it. You know, that if I was that good at it, I'd be a politician. If I had that skill set, that's what I'd do, because that would be my duty, I suppose. But that's not where my skills lie, and therefore I'm not going to ask people to listen to my opinions to the exclusion of all else. Now and again, I will, if I'm asked, I'll offer an opinion, but I think sometimes actors can, I think some actors are very good at it, and some actors are very well read and very well briefed and have a lot to say and contribute. I think I've got a little to contribute now and again, but I also don't want to be, you know, I don't necessarily feel that people should, just because I say something is so, I should expect people to agree with me. But if I have something of a platform now and again, and when the moment calls for it, I think if I can add a voice to a more educated one, to a better, a more articulate one, then I will.
It's interesting. Are we seeing, you know, Hollywood very much get behind, or largely get behind, the Democratic Party? But as Ricky Gervais pointed out in his Golden Globes kind of opener, that there is very much a danger of the hypocrisy of incredibly wealthy people telling people how to vote, and it being in fact counterproductive.
I think that can be true, yeah, which is why, like I say, I try not to do it too often. I think you have to choose your moments.
How much time do you spend in America?
Well, it really varies.
Well, not now, obviously, much
yeah,
at all.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been there for a long time. So, I mean, sometimes I work there, so I can be in and out, and I've spent large chunks of some years there, and other years I've not gone at all. So, but I love America. I love California. I love New York. I'm aware that California and New York do not represent all of America. And
no,
I don't know all of America, and I don't. Which again is why I want to speak to someone like Stacey Abrams, who's right in the middle of Atlanta politics, and try and understand it a bit from her perspective, from someone who is in the middle of it, and who is, whether you agree with her or not, she's indubitably steeped in it and well read and clever and
It's terrifying how polarized it is there, isn't it?
It is, and here too. I think it's something that we're all guilty of, not trying to understand the other side enough, possibly, and I think that doesn't seem to be getting any better. You know, we had it in this country we had it with the Scottish nationalism, the poll on Scottish nationalism, and now we have it. Then we had it with Brexit, and now we just seem to have it kind of institutionally. This sense that you're either for us or against us, that any sense of political nuance is seen as some kind of treachery, and I think that's a problem, and something that we as separate nations have to come to terms with and try and, it's very hard to move forward if there is just a sort of 50-50 divide down any country, don't you think?
Yeah. What role, if any, do you think that television, film and drama plays in trying to connect people together?
I think what art has always done is reflected the society that creates it. And in reflecting ourselves, we see ourselves and we perhaps get some objectivity on our lives and some understanding of the lives of the people that are around us. I think it's about empathy, and it's about, understanding ourselves and understanding each other. That's what art has always been about. That's why we've always told each other stories, to try and understand each other's existence. That sounds rather pompous, but that's what drama does. That's what theatre does. And that's why we tell each other stories, I think.
What's the criteria you set for yourself when taking on a role, David?
It varies, really. And I don't know. There are a variety of reasons why one may or may not accept a job. from an acting point of view, usually you get sent a script, and if that script connects with you in some way that feels exciting and new and different, then that's probably a reason to proceed with it. If it's working with people that you are excited to work with and inspired to work with and think would bring out the best in you or challenge you or surprise you, then I think that's what you're looking to do. I'm quite promiscuous with the genres that I enjoy. So I'm always looking for the next thing to be a little bit different than the thing I've done before, I suppose. That's always a temptation for me. But it's a good story at the end of the day.
Did you want to speak to Aaron Sorkin for this podcast? I know you're a huge fan of Aaron Sorkin.
I am a huge fan of Aaron Sorkin. I'd love that. If he wants to get involved, I'm sure we could still squeeze him in.
Do you, for people that you don't know here, Stacey Abrams, for instance, Whoopi Goldberg, do you make a direct, or do your people have to speak to their people?
There's sort of various ways these things happen. I mean, I did know Whoopi a bit, so it wasn't a cold call as such. I just didn't have her number, so we had to go through the sort of channels. With someone like Stacey Abrams, the production company, I don't even know. I just said, can we get to Stacey Abrams? And then a couple of weeks later, someone says she said yes. So I'm not even entirely aware of the machinations that go on.
Please tell me you have Star Trek's George Takei's number.
I don't have his number,
man, because that would have been amazing if you just texted him. He's an extraordinary individual, isn't he?
Oh, what a life that man has had. Quite apart from the whole Star Trek thing, which is extraordinary in itself. This slightly shonky TV series that got cancelled after three seasons and then went on to have six multi-billion-dollar movies after the show had been cancelled and they all thought they were out of work. Such a weird story. And amazing in itself, because that's part of our cultural furniture now, Star Trek, isn't it?
Yeah.
As a child, he was interned in a camp for Japanese Americans during the Second World War. As a child, he was locked up by his own country. So he's dealing with all that. He's a political activist. And then, of course, in later life, he's become an activist for LGBTQ rights. He came out in 2005, I think it was. He was the first, him and his husband, the first same-sex couple to get married in California. It was because Arnold Schwarzenegger wouldn't sign gay marriage into California law that he decided to come out and start making a stand. So he's had this incredible sort of new life in his later years as this extraordinary advocate for gay rights and gay marriage, and what a life. I mean, what an extraordinary life. He's in his 80s now, and he is sharp as a tack. Mm. I so enjoyed talking to him. It was extraordinary. There just wasn't enough time. With someone like him, you want to do a kind of three-part episode to kind of cover everything.
There is also just a level of electric eccentricity about him. I mean, we had William Shatner on the show not too long ago.
Not a lot of love lost between them.
No, to be fair.
And they're all very candid about it. There's no,
we didn't go there. Did you go there?
Oh yeah, we talked about William Shatner. Of course we did. Yeah, right. And he. But yes, there's not a lot of the usual actors' modesty between those guys, isn't there?
Oh, are you hoping then? Is that inspired you when you get to a certain age? That you will then be very honest about perhaps Michael Sheen, who you've never liked.
Oh, the stuff I could tell about him. Oh, the scandal I could unearth. I don't think I've mercifully never had an experience quite as... Well, because, of course, they were all locked together in this Star Trek universe for years, decades, because it just kept coming back. This show would not go away. And from the pilot in 1966 to the final movie in 1990 or something. They were locked in this kind of ongoing war, it would seem. But no, George was brilliant, fascinating, and very candid about all that.
So fast forward 20 years, we're not going to hear you, David Tennant, talk about how you massively hated someone that you worked with.
I don't think there's anyone who would fit that category.
That's what? To go through your entire working life?
Some people you might have a little niggle with now and again, but not... I mean, that's a sort of, it's a, it has a kind of Greek scale, doesn't it? It's like something from some kind of, you know, so the fact that, that it's been their fortune and their curse to be locked together in this sort of extraordinary, extraordinary partnership.
So you've never blanked anyone an award ceremony or anything?
I don't think I have. No, I mean, I'm proceeding with caution to this conversation in case I've forgotten something that will now come screaming out of the woodwork.
Someone will text in, or another guest I'll have on the show that'll ask about David Tennant. Oh yeah, he blanked me at the BAFTAs. Yeah, horrible man. Yeah. Of Dame Judi Dench, sitting down with her must be quite inspirational.
Well, she's just glorious, isn't she? I dare to call her a national treasure, which she recoiled from, of course, because she doesn't want to be that. No. I think what makes her so extraordinary is how human she is, how kind she is, how she's got sort of, she has this extraordinary talent. She just seems to have, it's like, when you watch her acting, I think it's like turning on a tap. It just this truth kind of gushes out in everything that she does, and it's so graceful and so pure somehow. And that is my experience of her as a woman, actually, that she's got a sort of serenity and a wickedness, actually, and a sense of humour, but it all comes from a place of real kindness. And there's something pure about that woman's soul that is why I think everyone loves her. I mean, I defy you to find a word of criticism about Judi Dench from anyone. It's like being. I mean, my wife and I did a thing in Stratford that Judy was involved in a few years ago for the Royal Shakespeare Company, and we just had one of our babies at the time, and so Georgia had our little one at the time there. And Judy came up and went, "Oh, is this the Tennant child?" And she had a look, just sort of, and as she walked away, Georgia went, "It's like she's been blessed." And it was. There's something about Judy that's just, there's a serenity and a wonderfulness to her. So that she agreed to do the podcast was meant so much. And she's just fabulous. She's great.
David, thank you for coming on the show. Good to speak to you.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Take care, man.
I'm very unnerved. You can see me, and I through this whole conversation, I haven't seen you. I've just got a black screen.
Well, you've got great
hair.
Doing
this? Are you doing this show in the dark? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I see.
It's part of me dealing with modern life.
Right. Right.
Bedroom's the same. Office the same. Right. It just helps me. Helps me cope.
I understand.
Take good care.
To talk to you.
It's really good to speak to you as well. Take care,
mate.
David. David Tennant does a podcast with is due to be released on August the 11th, which is, of course, today. So great timing that we got him on the show. The first series got over 10 million downloads and plays, so well worth checking out. And as you heard, there's some great guests. Okay, 32 minutes.